Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents New Suns, original speculative fiction by people of color. Edited by Nisi Shawl. Foreword by LeVar Burton. Narrated by Allison Johnson. There's nothing new under the sun, but there are new suns. Octavia E. Butler. Foreword, LeVar Burton. I am a huge fan of science fiction. Throughout my life, I have marveled at the powerful, even transformative nature of speculative storytelling. The influence science fiction storytelling is having in popular culture right now is amazing to behold, and as a genuine fan of the medium, I truly believe we are in a new age of speculative fiction. There is a pleasing phenomenon developing in the genre recently. The worthy inclusion of voices of color, which are being paid much overdue attention. Why this is important should be self-evident. However, for those sitting way in the back, consider this. We continually create the world we occupy, in our imaginations first, and only afterwards do we make those visions manifest in this world. So it stands to reason that a healthy society is one that respects and honors the voices of all of its components. For too long, the voices and visions for our future have been provided, for the most part, by and from a culturally European, if not Eurocentric, perspective. However, there is a change afoot. The works of Octavia E. Butler are becoming mainstream, and names like Nnedi Okorafor and Leslie Nneka Orema are bringing much-needed flavor to the narratives that help shape our future. I'm also a sucker for a good short story. In fact, reading short fiction is one of my favorite pastimes. I read a lot in this genre, and producing a podcast that celebrates the short story, LeVar Burton Reads, has not only deepened my love for the form, it has also provided me a platform to help audiences discover visionary voices. Nothing less than mastery is required from the storyteller who must grab an audience, create compelling characters, build the requisite conflict resolution, deliver a satisfying conclusion, often with a twist, and do it all in 5 to 50 pages. Whenever I am reading for the purest of pleasure, I am likely to have an anthology of science fiction short stories in my hand, such as this one. From the haunting, lyrical Give Me Your Black Wings, O Sister, by Silvia Moreno-Garcia, to Anil Menon's Robots of Eden, about a man's struggle to reconcile his feelings in an age where enhanced sensorial modification is commonplace. These stories are delivered by vibrant, authentic voices bursting to weigh in on the human condition and our journey of human evolution. There are familiar voices, like that of Stephen Barnes, an OG in the game, who delivers a wickedly satiric look at an advert targeted to a special demographic, interspersed with those with whom you may not be familiar. Jamie Goh, Darcy Little Badger, Indra Pramit Das. These are voices that are sorely needed if we are to chart a course for humanity that does not result in the destructive practices of our past. The exploration of space and our eventual close encounters with other intelligent species will require us to leave our colonizer mentality behind and embrace an attitude of openness and humility we have yet to cultivate, let alone master. When a world leader advocates for the creation of a militaristic space force to exercise dominance in the heavens, we are moving further than ever from Gene Roddenberry's United Federation of Planets. Instead, our exploration into the unknown should cause us to examine who we are as sentient beings, and science fiction as a tool for social change makes for a most welcome companion on our journey. You are about to read one of the finest collections of short stories from the world of speculative fiction I have ever encountered. The stories contained within will delight your sensibilities, inspire your wonderings, and connect you to your humanity, which is the point of good storytelling. But you don't have to take my word for it. The Galactic Tourist Industrial Complex, Tobias S. Buckell. When Galactics arrived at JFK, they often reeked of ammonia, sulfur, and something else that Tavi could never quite put a finger on. He was used to it all after several years of shuttling them through the outer tanks and waiting for their gear to spit ozone and adapt to Earth's air. He would load luggage, specialized environmental adaptation equipment, and cross-check the being's needs, itinerary, and sightseeing goals. What he wasn't expecting this time was for a 400-pound octopus-like creature to open the door of his cab 1,000 feet over the New Brooklyn Bridge, filling the cab with an explosion of cold screaming air and lighting the dash up with alarms. He also definitely wasn't expecting the alien to scream, "Look at those spires!" through a speaker that translated for it. So for a long moment after the alien jumped out of the cab, Tavi just kept flying straight ahead, frozen in shock at the controls. This couldn't be happening, not to him. Not in his broken-down old cab he'd been barely keeping going, and with a re-up on the Manhattan license due soon. To fly into Manhattan, you needed a permit. That was the first thing he panicked about, because he'd recently let it lapse for a bit. The New York Tourism Bureau hadn't just fined him, but suspended him for 3 months. Tavi had limped along on some odd jobs, tank cleaning at the airport, scrubbing out the backs of the cabs when they came back after a run to the island, and other muck work. But no, all his licenses were up to date, and he knew that it was a horrible thing to worry about as he circled the water near the bridge. He should be worrying about his passenger. Maybe this alien was able to withstand long falls, Tavi thought. Maybe, but it wasn't coming up. He had a contact card somewhere in the dash screen's memory. He tapped, calling the alien.
"Please answer, please."
But it did not pick up. What did he know about the alien? It looked like some octopus-type thing. What did that mean? They shouldn't have even been walking around, so it had to have been wearing an exoskeleton of some kind. Could that have protected it? Tavi circled the water once more. He had to call this in, but then the police would start hassling him about past mistakes. Somehow, this would be his fault. He would lose his permit to fly into Manhattan. And it was Manhattan that the aliens loved above all else. This was the real American experience, even though most of it was heavily built up with zones for varying kinds of aliens. Methane breathers in the garment district, the buildings capped with translucent covers and an alien atmosphere. Hydrogen types were all north of Central Park. He found the sheer number of shops fun to browse, but few of them sold anything of use to humans. In the beginning, a lot of researchers and scientists had rushed there to buy what the Galactics were selling, sure they could reverse engineer what they found. Turned out it was a lot of cheap alien stuff that purported to be made in Earth, but wasn't. Last year, some government agency purchased a real human sports car that could be shipped back to the home planet of your choice. It had an engine inside that seemed to be some kind of anti-gravity device that got everyone really excited. It exploded when they cracked the casing, taking out several city blocks. When confronted about it, the tall, furry, sauropod-looking aliens that had several other models in their windows on Broadway shrugged and said it wasn't made by them. They just shipped them to Earth to sell. But Galactics packed the city buying that shit when they weren't slouching beside the lakes in Central Park. If Tavi couldn't get to Manhattan, he didn't have a job. With a groan, Tavi tapped 911. There were going to be a lot of questions. He was going to be in it up to his neck. But if he took off, they'd have his transponder on file. Then he'd look guilty. With a faint clenching in his stomach, Tavi prepared for his day to go wrong. Tavi stood on a pier wearing a gas mask to filter out the streams of what seemed like mustard gas that would seep out from a nearby building in Dumbo. The cops, also wearing masks, took a brief statement. Tavi gave his fingerprint, and then they told him to leave.
"Just leave?"
There were several harbor patrol boats hovering near where the alien had struck the water, but there was a lack of urgency to it all. Mostly everyone seemed to be waiting around for something to happen. The cop taking Tavi's statement wore a yellow jumpsuit with logos advertising a financial district casino.
"Risk your money here, just like they used to in the old stock market. Win big, ring the old bell."
He nodded through his gas mask as he took notes.
"We have your contact info on file. We're pulling footage now."
But aren't you going to drag the river?
Go. There was something in the cop's tone that made it through the muffled gas mask and told Tavi it was an order. He'd done the right thing in an impossible moment. He'd done the right thing, right? He wanted to go home and take a nap, draw the shades and huddle in the dark and make all this go away for a day. But there were bills to pay. The cab required insurance, and the kinine fuel it used, shipped down from orbit, wasn't cheap. Every time the sprinklers under the cab misted it up and put down a new layer, Tavi could hear his bank account dropping. But you couldn't drive on the actual ground in Manhattan, not if you wanted to get a good review. Plus, the ground traffic flow licenses were even more whack than flying licenses, because the interstellar tourists didn't want to put up with constant traffic snarls. Trying to tell anyone that traffic was authentic old Manhattan just got you glared at. So, four more fares. More yellowed gas mixing into the main cabin of the cab, making Tavi cough and his eyes water. The last batch, a pack of wolf-like creatures that poured into the cab, chittering and yapping like squirrels, requested he take them somewhere serving human food.
Real human food, not that shit engineered to look like it, but doctored so that our systems can process it.
Tavi's dash had lit up with places the tourist bureau authorized for this pack of aliens that kept grooming each other as he watched them in his mirror.
Yeah, okay.
He took them to his cousin Jeff's place up in Harlem, which didn't have as many skyscrapers bubble-wrapped with alien atmospheres. The pack creatures were oxygen breathers, but they supplemented that with something extra running to their noses in tubes that occasionally wheezed and puffed a dust of cinnamon-smelling air. Tavi wanted some comfort food pretty badly by this point. While the aliens tried to make sense of the really authentic human menus out front, he slipped into the hot, gleaming stainless steel of the kitchens in the back.
Ricky!
Jeff shouted.
You bring those dogs in?
Yes,
Tavi confessed, and Jeff gave him a half-hug, his dreadlocks slapping against Tavi.
Maybe they'll tip you a million.
Shit! Maybe they'll tip you a trillion.
It was an old service job joke. How much did it cost to cross a galaxy to put your own eyes, or light receptors, on a world just for the sake of seeing it yourself? Some of the aliens who had come to Earth had crossed distances so great, traveled in ships so complicated that they spent more than a whole country's GDP. A tip from one of them could be millions. There were rumors of such extravagances. A dish boy turned rich suddenly, a tour guide with a place built on the moon. But the Tourism Bureau and the galactic-owned companies bringing the tourists here warned them not to overpay for services. The Earth was a fragile economy, they said. You didn't want to just run around handing out tips worth a year of some individual's salary. You could create accidental inflation or unbalanced power in a neighborhood. So the apps on the tourist systems, whatever types of systems they used, knew what the local exchange rates were, and paid folk down here on the ground proportionally. Didn't stop anyone from wishing, though. Jeff slid him over a plate of macaroni pie, some peas and rice, and chicken. Tavi told him about his morning.
You shouldn't have called the police, Jeff said.
And what, just keep flying?
The Bureau will blacklist you. They have to save face, and no one is going to want to hear about a tourist dying on the surface. It's bad publicity. You're going to lose your license into Manhattan. NYC Bureau's the worst, man.
Tavi cleaned his fingers on a towel, then coughed. The taste of cinnamon came up strong in his throat.
You okay?
Tavi nodded, eyes watering. Whatever the pack out there was sniffing, it was ripping through his lungs.
You need to be careful, Jeff said. Get a better filter in that cab. Nichelle's father got lung cancer off a bunch of shit coming off the suits of some sundivers last year. Doctors couldn't do nothing for him.
I know,
Tavi said between coughs. Jeff handed him a bag with something rolled up in aluminum foil inside.
Roti for the road. Chicken, no bone. I have doubles if you want.
No.
Jeff was being too nice.
He knew how Tavi was climbing out from a financial hole and had been bringing by extras after he closed up each night. Most of the food here was for non-human tourists, variations on foods that wouldn't upset their unique systems. Tavi had lied in taking the tourist pack here. The food out front was for the dog-like aliens. But the stuff in the bag was real, something Jeff made for folk who knew to come in through the back. Tavi did one more run back to JFK, and this time he flew a few loops around the megastructure. JFK Interspatial was the foot of a leg that stretched up into the sky, piercing the clouds and rising beyond until it reached space. It was a pier that led to the deep water where the vast alien ships that moved tourists from star to star docked. It was the pride of the U.S. Congress had financed it by pledging the entire country's GDP for a century to a galactic building consortium, so no one really knew how to build another after it was done, but the promise was that increased Manhattan tourism would bring in jobs. Because with the Galactic shipping in things to sell here in exchange for things they wanted, there wasn't much in the way of industrial capacity. Over half of the U.S. economy was tourism, the rest service jobs. Down at the bottom of JFK, the eager vacationers and sightseers disgorged into terminals designed for their varying biologies, and then were kitted out for time on Earth. Or, like Tavi's latest customer, just bundled into a can that slid into the back of a cab, and that was then dropped off at one of the hotels dwarfing Manhattan's old buildings. When the drop-off of the tourist in a can that Tavi couldn't see or interact with was done, he headed home. That took careful flying over the remains of LaGuardia, which pointed off from Brooklyn toward the horizon, the way it had ever since it collapsed and fell out of stable orbit. Land around LaGuardia's remains was cheap, and Tavi lived in an apartment complex roofed by the charred chunk of the one space elevator's outer shell.
"Home, sweet home," he said, coming in for a landing.
There was a burning smell somewhere in the back of the cab. Smoke started filling the cabin, and the impellers failed. He remained in the air, the canine misters doing their job and preventing him from losing neutral buoyancy, and coasted. Tavi wanted to get upset, hit the wheel, punch the dash, but he just bit his lip as the car finally stopped just short of the roof's parking spot. He had the misters spray some cancellation foam, and the car dropped a bit too hard to a stop.
"At least you got home,"
Sienna said, laughing, as he opened the doors to the cab and stumbled out.
"You know what I think of this galactic piece of shit?"
"He gets the job done."
Sienna poked her head into the cab, holding her breath. Her puffy hair bobbed against the side of the hatch.
"Can you fix it?"
he asked her.
"It was one of the dog things with the cinnamon breath. That gas they breathe catalyzes the O-rings. You need to spend some money to isolate the shaft back here."
"Next big tip," Tavi told her.
She crawled back out and let out the breath she'd been holding.
"Okay, next big tip. I can work on it if you split dinner with me."
She nodded at the bag Jeff had given him.
"Sure.
There's also a man waiting by your door. Looks like Tourist Bureau."
"Shit."
He didn't want anyone from the Bureau out here. Not in an illegal squat in the ruins of the space elevator now draped across this side of the world. There was no air conditioning. The solar panels lashed to the scrap hull rooftop didn't pump out enough juice to make that a reality. But the motion-sensitive fans kicked on, and the LED track lights all leapt to attention as Tavi led the beat-faced Tourist Bureau agent through the mosquito netting.
"Your cab is having trouble?"
The agent, David Kahn, had a tight haircut and glossy brown skin, the kind that meant he didn't spend much time outside loading aliens into the back of cabs. He had an office job.
"Sienna will fix it. She grew up a scrapper. Her father was one of the original decommissioners paid to work on picking LaGuardia up, before the contract was canceled and they all decided to stay put. Beer?"
Tavi passed him a sweaty red stripe from the fridge, which Kahn held nervously in one hand, as if he wanted to refuse it. Instead, he placed it against his forehead.
The man had been waiting a while in the heat, and he was wearing a heavy suit.
"So, I am here to offer you a grant from the Greater New York Bureau of Tourism,"
Khan started, sounding a little unsure of himself.
"A grant?"
"The Bureau is starting a modernization campaign to make sure our cabs are the safest on Earth. That means we'd like to take your cab in and have it retrofitted with better security, improved impellers, better airlocks. For the driver's safety."
"The driver?"
"Of course."
Tavi thought it was a line of bullshit. Human lives were cheap. There were billions teeming away on the planet. If Tavi ever stepped out, someone else would bid on his license to Manhattan, and he'd be forgotten in days, maybe even hours.
"Take it," Sienna said, pushing through the netting. "That piece of shit needs any help it can get."
Tavi didn't have to be told twice. He put his thumb to the documents, verbally repeated assent into a tiny red dot of light, and then Khan said a tow truck was on its way. They watched the cab get lifted onto its back, the patchwork of a vehicle that Tavi had come to know every smelly inch of.
"What about the dead alien?" Tavi asked.
"Well, according to the documents you just signed, you can never talk about the, incident again."
"I get it."
Tavi waved a salute at the disappearing cab and tow truck.
"I figured as much when you said you had a grant. But what happens to the alien? Did you ever find the body?"
Khan let out a deep breath.
"We found it, downstream of where it jumped."
"Why the hell did it do that? Why jump out?"
"It was out of its mind on vacation drugs. Cameras show the party started in orbit with a few friends, continued down the JFK elevator all the way to the ground."
"When do you send the body back to its people?"
"We don't."
Khan looked around, surprised.
"No one wants to know a high-profile cephaloid of any kind has died on Earth, so they didn't. The video of the fall no longer exists in any system."
"But they can track the body.
Already fired off via an old-school rocket aimed at our sun. That leaves no evidence here. Nothing happened on Earth. Nothing happened to you."
Khan shook hands with Sienna and Tavi and left. The next morning, a brand new cab was parked on the roof.
"Easier than scrubbing it all down for DNA," Sienna said. "The old one's probably on a rocket as well, just like the body, being shot toward the sun as we speak."
He scrambled up some eggs for his ever-hungry roomie and some extra for the Araji brothers next door. There were 30 other random clumps of real and found families living in welded-together scrap here. Several of them watched the sun creep over the rusted wreckage scattered from horizon to horizon as they ate breakfast. Tavi would head back into the drudgery of flying tourists around. Sienna would work at trying to pry something valuable out of the ruins. Just as they finished eating, a second cab descended from the clouds. It kicked up some dust as it settled in on the ground.
"Hey, asshole!" Sienna shouted. "If we all land on metal, we don't kick dust into everyone's faces."
Grumbling assent rose into the morning air. The door slid open, and Tavi felt his stomach drop. Another octopus-like alien stood on the ground looking up at them.
"I'm looking for the human named Tavi."
The speaker box on the exoskeleton buzzed.
"Is he here?"
"Don't say a thing," Sienna hissed. Sienna, who had all the smarts built up from a lifetime of eat or be eaten while scavenging in the wreckage.
"I am Tavi,"
Tavi said, stepping down toward the alien.
"You're an idiot," Sienna said.
She walked off toward the shadows under a pile of scrap and disappeared. The alien crouched in a spot of shade, trying to stay out of the sun, occasionally rubbing sunscreen over its photosensitive skin.
"I'm the co-sponsor of the unit last seen in your vehicle when it came down to your planet for sightseeing." Tavi felt his stomach fall out from under him.
Oh,
he said numbly. He wasn't sure what a co-sponsor was or why the alien's language had been translated that way. He had a feeling this alien was a close friend, or maybe even family member, of the one he'd witnessed jump to its death.
No one will tell me anything. Your representatives have done nothing but flail around and throw bureaucratic ink my way, the alien tourist said.
I'm really sorry for your loss,
Tavi said.
So you are my last try before offensors get involved,
the alien concluded.
Offensors?
The alien used one of its mechanized limbs to point up. A shadow passed over the land. Something vast skimmed over the clouds and blocked the sun. It hummed, and the entire land hummed back with it. Somehow, Tavi knew that whatever was up there could destroy a planet. Tavi's wristband vibrated. Incoming call. Khan. The world was crashing into him. Tavi felt it all waver for a moment, and then he took a deep breath.
All I wanted to do was the right thing, he muttered, and took the call.
Very big alien destroyers, David Khan said in a level but clearly terrified voice. We at the Greater New York Bureau of Tourism highly recommend you do whatever the being or beings currently in contact with you are asking, while also, acknowledging that we have no idea where the missing being they are referring to is. Please hold for the president.
Tavi flicked the bracelet off.
What do you want?
Tavi asked the alien.
I want to know the truth, it said.
I see you have an advanced exotic worlds encounter suit. Would you like a real human beer with me?
If that helps, it said. You have such a beautiful planet, so unspoiled, paradisiacal. I was swimming with whales in your Pacific Ocean yesterday.
Tavi sat down and gave the alien a red stripe. It curled a tentacle around it, pulled it back towards its beak. They watched the trees curling around the LaGuardia debris shiver in the wind, the fluffy clouds ease through the pale blue sky. They deliberately sat with their backs to the section of the sky filled with the destroyer.
I've never been to the Pacific,
Tavi admitted.
Just the Caribbean, where my people come from, and the Atlantic.
I'm a connoisseur of good oceans, the alien said. These are just some of the best.
We used to fish on them. My grandfather owned a boat.
Oh, does he still do that? I love fishing.
He started chartering it out,
Tavi said.
The Galactics bought out the restaurants, so he couldn't sell to his best markets anymore. They own anything near the best spots, and all around the eastern seaboard now.
I'm sorry to hear that.
About your friend?
Tavi took a big swig.
They jumped out of my cab when it was in the air. They were in an altered state.
There was a long silence. Tavi waited for the world to end, but it didn't. So he continued, and the alien listened as he told his story.
And there were no security systems to stop them from jumping? It asked when he finished.
There were not. On that cab.
Wow, it said. How authentically human. How dangerous. I'll have to audit your account against the confessions of your bureau, but I have to say I am very relieved. I suspected foul play, and it turns out it was just an utterly authentic primitive world experience. No door security.
Overhead, long fiery contrails burned through the sky.
What is that?
Tavi asked, nervous.
Independent verification, the alien said. It stood up and jumped down to its cab.
It looked closely at the rear doors. I could really just jump out of these, couldn't I?
It opened the door, and Tavi, who had hopped over the roof and down the stairs, caught a glimpse of a pale-faced driver inside.
Sorry, friend,
he thought. There were more shadows descending down out of space, larger and larger vessels moving through the atmosphere far above.
What is happening?
Tavi asked, mouth dry.
News of your world has spread,
it said.
You are no longer an undiscovered little secret. Finding out that we can die just in a cab ride, where else can you get that danger?
The cab lifted off and flew away. Sienna came back out of the shadows.
They're over every city now. They're offering ludicrous money for real estate.
Tavi looked at the skies.
Did you think it would ever stop?
She put a hand on his shoulder.
Beats them blowing us up, right? They do that sometimes, to other worlds that fight it.
He shook his head.
There's not going to be anything left for us down here, is there?
Oh, they'll never want this.
She spread her arms and pointed at the miles of space elevator junk.
And I still have a new cab,
he said. She put a hand on his shoulder.
Maybe these new galactics coming down over the cities tip better.
And for the first time in days, Tavi laughed.
That's always the hope, isn't it?
Dear Dancer, Kathleen Alcala.
Ha! She said, jiggling the wrench. I've got you!
The pipe came loose with a grating sound, and she reached in and unscrewed it the rest of the way. Rusty water dribbled out the end as she scuttled from under the house, waving the pipe section in the air. Brownish water spattered her shirt. It felt good.
Found it! It will be easy to fix, she said,
wondering if they could find pipe the same diameter and long enough to repair the plumbing. This was the fifth house she had helped rehab, and Tater was beginning to think of herself as an expert in the undersides of houses. Shonda took the pipe from her and fingered the rusty hole.
How are you going to find the right size? We've got a whole pile from the other houses around here. One of them must have used the same size, maybe even the same plumber in the first place. All these houses were built about the same time.
The sun, Mother's sun, blazed down, and Tater pulled her hat forward from where it hung down her back on a string.
We'd better get home.
It was 5 bells since first light, and unless they planned to spend the rest of the day under the house, they needed to get back. Walking single file, Shonda took the lead, poking any suspicious-looking soil with her walking stick before proceeding. Tater carefully set her feet in Shonda's prints until they came to a place where the houses were lively with people preparing for midday siesta. Chia was just pulling protective burlap sacking back over a patch of taters after digging up a few. The gray nubs did not look like much as they sat steaming on the ground, but washed and sliced into brilliant purple discs, they would glow. Tater's mom had named her after the naturalized Ozettes. Brought from Peru by long-ago voyagers, the potatoes had taken to the Northwest like, well, no other plant or animal. Tater was proud of her unusual name, and secretly hoped she was like them, ordinary at first look, but gem-like on the inside. Rooted. Tater was still carrying the pipe.
What you going to do with that? Asked Chia. Match it, then recycle. The rest of the pipes held up good. This one is far enough gone, reuse might be able to smash it into dust for the iron.
Tater splashed some water on her neck and hung up her hat. Out of the sun now, she rolled up her sleeves and served herself soup she found cooling on the stove. Chia would stay up cooking so that the day crew would have something to eat when they woke from their midday slumbers around sundown. Nights worked second shift. It used to be called graveyard shift, but that made too many people sad.
What do you think when the sun goes down and every light takes on a spectral aspect? My eyes ever deceitful, ever necessary for one who relies on visual cues, who only trusts the stimuli she takes in through the range of light and motion.
The angular bounce of light at the solstice, of sun streaming directly into our eyes, as though to make up for all the days when we see no sun at all. How our limbs loosen, and we tilt back our heads with a slight smile, drinking it in. Who can deny the intoxication of sunlight, the touch of gold as it runs down our arms from our fingertips? Our thighs grow slack as our lips part to drink in the pearly heat. Our pens rest on their tables as our minds glide away from the task at hand. Tater read a page in her aunt's diary, then set it aside. She had been given it years before, but had not tried to read it until being assigned to housing rehab. She found it hard to sleep out here on the edges. Reading the old diary helped. She loved imagining what it was like before, when the sun was scarce. Tater liked stroking the soft edges. It was the only book she owned herself, and she found herself fingering the pages like worry beads. Tater lay back carefully in her hammock so as not to flip over, afraid of and grateful for the distance from the floor. Not that rats wouldn't jump or climb up onto hammocks if they felt like it, but Tater still felt better this way. Now she tried to imagine Aunt Ceci's life, when water stayed in its place and the sun was a welcome embrace against the damp cold. She could barely remember being cold. "Not sleeping?" asked Shonda as she came in.
"Not yet."
Shonda unhooked her own hammock from where it hung coiled on the wall and took it outside. She preferred to sleep under the giant Doug fir that sheltered their house, a tree they had defended with guns and clubs early on. Tater could smell the taters cooking. There was an herb with them, something she could not quite place as she drifted off to sleep. Late afternoons were for domestic chores. That included upkeep on the house where they homesteaded. If they could defend it for 7 years, the house was theirs. Most people stayed on wait lists until a house opened up in the center, but that could take forever. Homesteading on the edges offered larger properties, enough to grow food, and also dangers. But even for the edges, there were wait lists of people stacked sky high in mass housing. Tater barely remembered before, and there were some things in between that she could not think about at all. Shonda gently shook Tater awake. It felt as though she had just dozed off, a dream of deer picking their way across a clearing fading gently from her mind.
"Your turn to wash."
Tater dragged herself back to the waking world. She might have been having a true dream, but if that's what it was, it would come back. She would need to let the others know if it did. When she was a child of 8, it became clear that Tater got the dreaming. When she was 14, she was given her aunt's journal. Ceci was an original dreamer, born in Mexico, raised in the U.S. in secrecy by her family. Given every advantage to learn the language, the ways of these people so that she could rescue the rest of her family from the label them. Everyone in Ceci's family, including Tater's mom, worked every waking moment to keep Ceci, the youngest, in school, and living long enough to pull her family through the torturous knots of the legal system. She succeeded, and her nieces and nephews became us as well. But that was all before. Dream. Salal, salal, thimbleberry, grass. Smell of humans. Water. Stillness, stillness. Light slanting in for longer days. Humans took their cues from the animals and had become diurnal. Afternoons were for chores, but night was for guarding. Second shift got up and had breakfast with the day shift's dinner. Tater could spot nights on sight. Like her, they had a dreamy look, with large eyes and slightly larger nostrils. There was a lot of talk about whether this was adaptation after so few generations, or just an affinity of knights for knights as partners, since that's who they got to know anyway. Every household had a combination of days and nights. Tater joined the table next to Anna, one of the few knights she spoke to regularly.
"Sup?" "Not too much. Just talking about the bear spotted at the north end."
"Again? They've no fright."
Sorrel's pretty sure she heard them talking again.
You mean like people talk?
Yeah. She swears she can almost understand them. Sorrel was at the other end of the table, describing the bear sighting. She stood up and lumbered down the length of the table, stopping to smell each of their plates, setting them laughing.
Are the bears changing, or is it just you?
Someone called out. Sorrel took her seat. They were eating eggs tonight, gathered from the summer chickens.
Could just be me,
she said honestly. I've got so I can smell people coming, even tell sometimes who it is. Sorrel flexed her powerful hands and set to her meal.
Tater and me are going to need a full crew tomorrow, said Shonda. 5 people. Time to replace the roof on the Dennyway house so we can start on the inside. Plumbing's almost done. Tater's fast.
Who will you work with next? Asked Anna. Tater blushed and looked down.
Not for me to say.
All in good time, said Chia as she began to clear the table. She might have other dons she wants to develop. Tater thought about that. Sometimes she forgot that she could choose what she wanted to work on, who she wanted to work with, as long as it was for the common good. It hadn't been like that before, or even for a while after. Again, she had the strong feeling of the deer in the ravine nearby, and when she looked up, Sorrel had stopped eating and was staring down the table at her, still and alert. Tater pushed out her chair and stood up.
I've got a dream now, she said.
Shonda pointed at Anna and Chia, who flanked Tater, and escorted her out of the kitchen. Tater's team did not have a room set aside just for dreaming. She was the only one in their household, and they all agreed it was a waste of space in their small but ship-shaped house. But there was a bed in the main bedroom that was set aside for her. It folded out of the wall to offer a deep, safe space, and a clear story cast a diffuse light in the room during the day. The bed was lowered, and Tater climbed out of her day clothes into a soft cotton gown that did not inhibit her movement. That gown, of pure cotton from before, was probably the most valuable thing the team owned. Tater was humbled by their goodness to her every time she put it on. Anna got a mug of water and Chia a towel. Sometimes the dreams could be rough, and Tater lost control of her body. By the time they had tucked Tater into the bed and settled into chairs on either side of her, she was no longer seeing the room and people around her. It had been a few months since she had last dreamed, and the household was in some ways relieved to see what further instructions they might receive. She could still faintly hear their comforting voices.
Duérmete, duérmete, Anna urged.
Sometimes the dream was clear and direct. Other times, they could only speculate at what it meant and what they were expected to do with the information. But no one doubted the authenticity of the dreams. Tater was trying to run through the forest. This was big forest, not trash trees and overgrown scotch broom. Vines grabbed at her legs as she ran, causing her to stumble. Snatching at a handful of leaves to break her fall, she felt the painful jolt of nettles in the palm of her hand. Tater gathered all her concentration into her thighs and leaped, now, clear of her human body, bounding without effort through the underbrush. Something was behind her, but she could not see it. The smell was pungent, like fire, like chemicals burning a hole in a metal container. Her human thoughts soon fled as she spotted another of her kind and followed, leaping sideways and forward so as to throw off any pursuers. She crashed through salal and salmonberry, fiddlehead fern and seeps where freshets rose when it rained. This was the damp country she remembered, the before of her childhood, when everyone had enough to eat, clothes to wear, homes to live in, when children went every day to school to learn to live in a world that no longer existed. Tater held the raised sides of the dream bed and rode it like a little boat, rocking and bucking as she moaned and made strange noises. Anna and Chia were there to try to keep her from hurting herself, as she had on occasion, and to take note of anything she might say out loud while in the grip of her dream. They made themselves comfortable and didn't have to say that they were pleased to have finished their dinners ahead of the dream.
When Tater woke, it was dark and very quiet. She was alone. She listened to the silence for a few minutes before rising. Climbing out of the bed, she walked out to the kitchen. A single lamp burned on the table. The dishes lay scattered, some with food still on them, as though abandoned shortly after Tater left. She stepped in something wet and looked down to see a dropped mug. Walking carefully, she returned to the bedroom and climbed back into the dreaming bed. When Tater woke again, it was deep night, and again she was alone in the house. She listened to the silence for a few minutes before rising. The lantern still burned in the kitchen. Tater took a flashlight and walked out on the porch. The night shift should have been out on the perimeter making noise, but Tater heard nothing. A strong smell of bear filled her nostrils, and she returned inside to bolt and bar the door. Tater could not tell if she was dreaming or not. This happened sometimes. Her surroundings felt real, but where was everyone? Wouldn't she have heard something if there had been an attack? Wouldn't they have taken her with them, even if she was in the throes of a dream? Tater climbed back into the dream bed once again, just in case. Tater woke a third time, her left hand sticky where it had gripped the raised edge of the bed. When she lifted her hand and opened the palm, it was sticky with blood. Tater woke at 10 bells. Chia snored daintily in the chair beside her. Voices came from the kitchen, laughing and the sound of dishes and cooking. Tater pulled on her clothes, folding the gown gently across the coverlet. Chia woke and helped return the little bed to the wall. In the kitchen, they were greeted with a clatter of dishes being dried and stored. Anna sang a high, silly song, and the smell of nettle soup bubbling on the stove filled the kitchen. Sorrel walked up to Tater and reached out. Tater flinched, and Sorrel stopped before gently bringing her hand down on Tater's shoulder. "You've got news for us." Tater opened her hand to show Sorrel where the stiffened blood had resolved into the outlines of a map, their own settlement at the center, the edges stretching beyond. They greeted the night with a collective roar. The members of the house were in full regalia, Tater wearing her inherited cocoon rattle leggings. She lifted her canes, one in each hand, and set the tip of each down the way a deer daintily makes its way through the forest. She turned her gaze this way and that, in mimicry of the deer, careful not to lose the antlers strapped to her head. The drummer beat a bowl with two sticks turned upside down over a larger bowl of water, creating a booming sound that carried for miles. Anna's voice wailed a descant. The dancers made their way forward and back, turning sideways in unison to appear larger to the unseen enemy. "Arise, arise, fair sun, and kill the envious moon." Dancers from other houses flanked them, creating a front of noise and light against the outside. Tater felt vulnerable in her soft doeskin clothing, conscious of how exposed her throat was each time she turned her head, knew that the bandage on her left hand showed she might be wounded. This is how they took back the world, step by step, song by song. At the end of the night, new fence posts would be pounded into place, new fences strung. Tater lifted and set her canes carefully. The extra points of support allowed her to keep her feet close together as she pounded the ground with them, directing her energy deep into the earth. Tater realized that if she ever had a daughter, she would name her Ozette. This was new, the consciousness that she might have a future beyond herself. Tater's face shone in the flickering light. It was good to be alive.